the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fucking Ham Palace guards? How are you? Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF. Today, Jimmy Vivino is on the show. Jimmy Vivino is very important to me. Jimmy is the guitar player of the Basic Cable Band. And on the Conan O'Brien show, he's been playing on the Conan O'Brien show since the beginning of the Conan O'Brien show, but he is the band leader on the current configuration. Before, he was playing under the leadership of Max Weinberg. The reason he's important to me is that I play guitar most of my life. Oh boy. So yeah, I was 8 or 9 when I first started taking guitar lessons. And at that point, I was playing a big old weird acoustic harmony guitar that my dad used to own. And I was certainly no savant. I was no prodigy. Is that what it is? Yeah, I was, you know, me and my brother would play and we'd sing and we'd time out the amount of songs we had to play to get through the practices that my mother made us do. I think we played Johnny B. Goode. I think we played Country Roads. I think we played, what was the other one? Rocky Raccoon, you know, stuff that we could get through and stuff that was simple. But nonetheless, guitar has been part of my life for most of my life. And Jimmy is a great guitar player. Now, I'll come back around to Jimmy. Now, here's the deal with me and guitar playing. I was in a couple of bands that knew 3 songs. I never was in a band that played a real gig or that had a real set list. I've never been any good at figuring out songs. I've never been had the focus or the attention to figure out songs. You know, it wasn't until I learned a few scales from a teacher, Vaughn McMillan, back in Albuquerque. But I think I feel like I've told you all this. The point is, I've never been a guy that's had that much confidence on the guitar. I've never understood until very lately, until recently in the last few years, that, you know, you play with feeling, and if you're, you know, proficient enough, you can put something together for yourself. I always judge myself against other people. I always thought I was just okay, and I think I am just okay. But I never put a band together, and oddly, it's one of the only regrets I have in my life is not really indulging or engaging in my passion to play music. I've done a little for you. But like that, you know, it's I know it's not too late. Maybe I'll do it. But here's how Jimmy's important. Jimmy Vivino and I talked at some point during my, you know, one of my many appearances on the old Conan show. And I just would talk to him about guitars. And then he at one point he said, you want a guitar to fool around with? I'm like, hell yeah. So he gave me one of his beautiful old guitars. And he's a guy with a lot of guitars. And, you know, and I play it. And I was like, thank you. And then he started, like, when I do the show, he'd show me a couple riffs, you know. He'd show me a couple licks. And, like, he was just starting to open my brain up a little more to playing. Because I never learned new things. I'd always just sort of improvise and do my own thing. I knew a few scales. I could feel around. But he actually opened my brain up to as a grown man, to learn guitar, you know, to sort of feel it. In, you know, he would just, it would almost be like he'd dole out these licks as soon as I could handle them. Like, he would just show me little tricks, mostly blues licks, when I do Conan. And then it got to this point where every time I do Conan, there was an amp and a guitar waiting in my dressing room for me just to fuck off. And then he'd come in and we'd talk a little bit about blues or about players and about stuff. And then I'd go, well, show me that thing. Show me a new thing. And he'd show me a new thing. So on some level, Jimmy's been giving me guitar lessons for the past 10 years, very spontaneously and sporadically, maybe 2 or 3 times a year, but he's been giving me guitar lessons, you know, and every time, you know, he would show me what the real guy was doing, whether it be Freddie King or Albert King or Peter Green or whoever I was sort of like studying at the time. He'd show me how it's really done. He'd show me some tricks. Like, I think recently, we talked about vibrato a little bit. I have an innate ability to pull down on the vibrato, and that sounds good, but to actually make some deliberate choices about pushing up on vibrato. I hope this isn't boring anybody, but the thing is that, you know, Jimmy's is a great player. He's got a record out, Jimmy Vivino and the Black Italians, 13 Live. You can get the record. You can go right to his site. You can go to jimmyvivino.com. He's just a great player. He's played with everybody. This is an amazing conversation. It was amazing for me to, you know, to really talk to a guy who is a, He's a session player. You know, he's a background player. You know, he's a backup musician. And that's all he ever wanted to be, and he's been doing it all his life. And lately, I don't really buy guitars. I've gotten a few as gifts. I recently bought an acoustic guitar that I like. I've had a couple of guitars most of my life. And the exciting thing for me is that, and this is tangible to me. And it's not tangible to me necessarily in any other part of my life. Look, I know that I've gotten more comfortable with myself. I know that as a stand-up and as a broadcaster and as what I do here, I've obviously grown into it, and I've become comfortable here. And I'm doing the best work I've ever done in my chosen fields, be it, you know, comedy or podcasting here. But with guitar, I know for a fact that I've learned how to become a better player in the last few years, just because I've learned for a fact that I've always liked to just play guitar to get out of myself and to meditate almost, and to just kind of noodle. Sometimes when I'm watching TV, I'll just sit there and I'll run finger exercises for no reason other than to do it, to keep vital, to keep at it. And because of Jimmy, and because of some of the doors he's provided for me with just very small things, man. You know, I mean, just like little tricks. You know, he's just opened me up to know that I can learn and continue to try to make the instrument my own as best I can. But like, I am so hard on myself, and I know that some of you other people have this experience with almost anything. It could be. It's just you have these expectations compared to what? You know, like, what do I really expect out of it? What if I can't be a virtuoso or a great guitar player? It's like, if I can play with some feeling for my own purposes, good. You know, I should probably record more of it. But Jimmy was important because of that. And I did get a new guitar recently. I did. It took me 2 years to talk, to get Gibson, to get behind me, you know, and give me a 335. It took a few years. And a 335 is a beautiful fucking guitar. And I never thought I would have a guitar like this. And I never thought I would feel a guitar like this. And I never thought that I earned a guitar like this. That I should have one. This guitar, I almost slept with it the other night. You know, I'm not gonna lie to you. I almost slept with it. I'm not really that guy. Like I said, I'm not a guitar wizard or anything, but I almost slept with this guitar. I got it. It's a, you know, it's a vintage Sunburst 335. And I still don't think I deserve this guitar. I just don't. And I fucking love it. It feels like, you know, it's got some weight to it. I'm sitting here holding it, and I'm not even doing it justice because you can't see me. I'm just sitting here holding this guitar. I'm just going to end up, like, you know, saving some money and stopping this and just, you know, playing small gigs, playing some weird song list of songs I like and maybe a couple I've written when I wrote it. You'll be the first to hear my songs if I write them, if I have the courage to do it. I'm surprised I have the courage to play for you, you know, at the end of these shows. But anyways, we're going to talk to Jimmy Vivino, and I just wanted to really talk about how important he was in my life. Look, I've gone on and off in my life where I didn't play guitar as regularly as I do now, but I do it now for my sanity. You know, not to prove anything to anybody, but, you know, it's one of the few things I really enjoy, and I really enjoyed talking to Jimmy. Thrilled right now to share with you my conversation with Jimmy Vivino from the Basic Cable Band. So listen. Enjoy. I didn't know that, you know, someone just told me that your brother is Uncle Floyd.
Only people, we're not recording yet, right?
Sure we are.
Oh, only people who are...
New Jersey.
Really from the tri-state area.
Right.
But found it. You know, stumbled upon it.
How long was he on the air for?
Well, 20-something years.
Right, forever.
Yeah, but you know what he did? Before there was FCC rules, he would go out to the local, like, pet store, yeah, the bakery.
Right.
You want to buy some time on a TV show?
Yeah.
$100.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He'd go to 20 guys.
And he'd just give them a mention?
And yeah, he'd give him a mention. He made little commercials. He would pay, like, I don't know, something like $500 to rent the studio for the day and do five shows in one day.
Right.
And and collect money from these guys all week long.
What channel was it on?
First, it started on UHF.
Right.
Which is foreign to
any kid
today.
So he was just a freak.
Yeah, channel 68 on UHF.
Right.
And then they moved him to another channel. He come on right after the stock market report.
Was it a real gig? At the first, it was his own thing, right?
It was his own thing. And he, you know.
How much older is he?
He's like 4 years older than me.
Yeah.
And he and he's a man out of time anyway.
Right,
so,
I don't know him.
You know, he found, you know, his friends were like in vaudeville.
Really?
Mickey Deems and Joey Faye and older guys.
How do you know those guys?
And he pursued them the way I pursued old blues players.
Right. Oh, really?
He pursued old vaudeville comedians and worked with them. There was still some burlesque. He worked with Ann Corio and burlesque. And there was still some burlesque shows going, so he was
in New York.
In New York,
and would he put him on the Uncle Floyd show?
He would if he would find those guys. Yeah, but then the punks found him, so all of a sudden it became hip. David Bowie was showing up at the studio.
Come on, know?
Yeah, yeah. And Johansson, the Dolls were there. You know, Johnny Thunders, all these cats, man. Cyndi Lauper at the time.
We're hanging out at the Uncle Floyd
and
studio.
And the Ramones were the biggest fans.
Of Uncle Floyd?
Yeah, yeah. So I got turned on to that by him by accident because, you know, I was into soul music and all that stuff.
You you were how old, though, when he started?
Well, see, I was probably 18 or 17.
When he started doing
18
it?
18 when he started
so
doing it.
So he's just this weird kid.
Yeah, he was like 22, you know, and already like an old man, though. When we were kids, we had a dance team, you know, the three of us.
Jerry?
So, Jerry, me, and Floyd, that's it. And,
yeah.
So, you know, we'd just tap dance and then play our instruments and then sing and then do some comedy, you know. And he would insist, man, when we were kids, I had this little tape recorder. We'd say, record coconuts, you know, and then learn this part.
Right.
And then tonight, we're going to do it in my room. We're going to do this scene.
You're going to work it out?
We're going to work out this scene. And he would put on these old records, 78s, and he had, because he used to clean out houses, old ladies' houses.
So he was one of the, he was into that, an old era. He was that guy. He's a man out of time.
A man out of time. So I'd have to learn, you know, Jerry got to learn Harpo's lines, which were none. And I had to learn all the, you know, Ravelli shit.
Right.
That's a nice. He was always Groucho.
Chico.
Yeah. And then he became friends with Joe Franklin and Georgie Jessel and all these guys.
Franklin's another one of those guys, though. You know, it was like it took him a long time to get hip, but it was freak hip, you know?
He's still alive, man. I was in at Patsy's on 55th, 56th Street or wherever it is down there. And, you know, having a business meeting with some guys, you know.
Yeah.
And Joe Franklin walks in, and it's like, you know, he just looks like a dead man walking, you know. Like he's made up, like he could just go right to the coffin, man.
Well, it's weird, the Jersey thing, like, you know, with your brother, but also, like, I don't remember who I was talking to, but there was that Channel 11, man.
Yeah.
You know, in Jersey, they played all the Stooges. I was talking to Leonard Maltin about it.
We grew up with Joe Bolton and the Stooges.
And the Bowery Boys.
Yeah,
Little Rascals.
Captain Jack with the Popeyes, the old Fleischer Popeyes.
Right, and they were all on that one channel. What was it?
Channel 11, WPIX. It was a New York channel. And then there was Chuck McCann was on there with Let's Have Fun. And Chuck McCann was a genius. And then Channel 5, you had Sandy Becker and Uncle Fred Scott and these other guys.
Yeah.
You know, and they were kiddie shows for adults, really.
Right. And what was Soupy on?
Soupy was, I can't remember what channel. I would guess maybe 5 or...
Floyd came after?
Oh, Floyd acknowledged that Soupy was his, like, one of his biggest biggest influences. Soupy and Chuck McCann, you know, I don't know where the idea came into his head to do a kiddie show with puppets and but that was for stoners, you know, for really what we called punks in those days.
Sure.
And those guys latched onto it and started appearing. They would come and lip sync, you know, their records.
Who?
The Ramones
were on Uncle Floyd.
Yeah. Oh man, all the Bowie. You know,
who's got that footage? Is it on YouTube?
You know, some of it may be, but you know how it was then. Tape over it.
That's right.
we were doing a live show, and Bowie had John Lennon and somebody else, Tony Visconti, with him. And they were sitting, they were in the bottom line. There was like two dressing rooms, one on either side of the stage.
Who was the band?
Small. Your band? The band was me and my brother Jerry and a couple guys from Jersey, Ed Alstrom.
Which band was that?
It was the Vivino Brothers band.
Okay.
And so we were the band. And then, so we were all standing. We didn't get to go in the dressing rooms because Floyd had 20 other people. So he comes up to me and I'm talking to Tony.
Oh, it was a live Floyd show.
Yeah, live show at the bottom. I'm talking to Visconti and Bowie and
Lennon?
And he's in there too, but he's like quiet and you don't bother him.
They came to see a live Floyd show?
Yeah, and then Floyd comes out and says, Jimmy, get these guys out of here. We got to do a show. I don't care who they are. And I'm like, oh, my God. And they love it.
Yeah.
They're loving being kicked out.
Because he's your brother's like, kind of a nut.
Everybody kisses our ass. But this guy, he could care. So they loved him even more. And Bowie,
was he really like that or was that an act?
He was really like that. And he still is.
Is he a little Asperger-y or
what?
Well,
no. Because if Mickey Deems was back there or Joey Faye or one of those guys.
He'd be like, welcome.
Yeah. Myron Cohen was back there.
He'd be saying,
kissing their ass. You know?
But not David
They had
Bowie.
No time for rock and roll, and they loved that he had no time for that.
So he was a real kook.
Bowie wrote a song even about Floyd.
Really?
And played it for me and my brother Jerry one time. He said, sit down, I want to play you something. And it's a line in the Twinkle, Twinkle, Uncle Floyd. And it's from about four albums back, four or five albums back. And he was so happy to play. He said, would you please show this to Floyd? I said, sure, if he'll look at anything on videotape, you know.
Oh, he doesn't.
Well, you know, it's like.
Is he still like this?
78, you know, everything's 78.
He's still like that.
Oh, he's still like this, yeah.
Do you guys get along?
Oh, we get along great, you know. But, you know, like his friends, Jerry Vale, a guy that he worked with a lot, just passed away. You know,
Jerry Vale, the singer?
Yeah, the singer. And like Pat Cooper was a buddy of his.
He's still around.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, and you know, and they'll do, you'll do shows together. Italian shows, you know, and just going out. And then he did Italian radio for many years up in the Bronx.
He spoke Italian?
Yeah.
You speak Italian?
No, he learned. And you know why? So he could go up to Arthur Avenue and get free food and say, you want me to, again, it was like, you want me to talk about your show on the radio? He could walk home with a basket of food, you know?
So how'd you guys all end up in show business? Was your father a show business guy?
Because our father was probably the most talented trumpet player I ever heard. But he was from a family of carpenters, so he wasn't allowed to do that. He came over here on a boat. You know, he was born in 1927 in Italy. Came over in like 1930, something like 30, 33.
Yeah.
He wasn't allowed to pursue music, though he did play. You know, I had an uncle that ran the Plaza Ballroom in Paterson, and he had a big band, and my father got to play in it. And all the family, but they were carpenters still, you know. And for my father to have three sons, and abandon the fact that he should have had a construction empire with three more sons, the last thing he was going to do was force us into that.
Right.
So if we showed interest, he would take us for lessons. If I wasn't ready for my lesson, I was a trumpet player.
Yeah.
Up until I was like 23, I switched to guitar.
Really?
I played trumpet and then organ.
And the only gigs your dad ever did was with your uncle?
No. He didn't do a lot of gigs. He did the gigs with the Frank Viv Orchestra, you know.
Yeah.
And worked in the army. Well, Louis Armstrong. Let me see. He loved Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
He loved Roy Eldridge, Bunny Berrigan, you know, all those.
And he could really do it?
Oh, he could play. Oh, man, he could play. He was great, man, and he could sing good, too. But he wasn't allowed to do that.
But
so
he worked as a carpenter.
Was a carpenter. And he would take us on the job just so we would not want to do that.
And this was him and his brothers?
Well, him and his brothers, yeah, and my grandfather, you know. And they built, like, all the Brielle Estates in Point Pleasant when we lived down the shore. You know, they built all these, in the 50s, there were all these things going up. Man.
Right.
It's just like, you know, they're big developments. And so they worked down in, you know, all the way from the Jersey Shore, all the way up to Newark, all the way up to Paterson.
And you grew up in Paterson.
Yeah, yeah.
Paterson's heavy.
And there was a house. Yeah, well, Lou Costello's from Paterson.
Right.
So there's my brother right away was, I want to be like Lou Costello. You
sure,
know?
Right. So that was it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this stuff is close to my heart because my grandmother, my family's from Jersey, so my grandmother, they lived in Pompton Lakes, New Jersey.
Yeah, which was probably rural as hell when they were.
I guess kind of. It's a little town.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't quite rural. I mean, Butler was a little rural.
Verona, Butler, Pompton Lakes.
Like my grandfather used to own a hardware store and an appliance store. He'd sell washing machines to the hill people.
Route 23 was kind of new up there, going up that way.
But she used to, I can't remember
The people from Mahwah, the Jackson Whites.
The Jackson Whites. He used to sell them washing machines.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a trip, man.
And there was no 287, though, connecting that mountain like there is now.
I didn't know that.
Then they came down the mountain, really, into Lincoln Park.
I know my mother knew a Jackson White in Haskell was where his hardware store was.
Yeah.
And there was a guy that had a horse or a donkey or
something.
Come
down for supplies.
Right. Yeah, crazy, right? But New Jersey, I'm trying to remember why the hell we went into Patterson.
We saw the Fabian Theater in Patterson. Yeah. We saw the Three Stooges live.
You did?
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm now, I'm 59 now. Yeah, actually.
You look great.
I was born in 55, right? Okay. So that makes me 59, right? Yeah. But I'm a musician. I don't grow. You know, I'm done.
But clearly, you didn't beat yourself up as much as some musicians.
No, I did for a long time, and then I stopped, and then I'm back. But I'll tell you what.
You beat it, why not get back
always
on it?
Always because of a girl, right?
Uh-huh.
We do things, we can get into that, but you know. Yeah. We saw the Three Stooges. Anyway, the Three Stooges made a movie where they go to the moon. It was like Joe Derita, the later three.
Yeah.
And we're all excited, and we're at the Fabian Theater. It's probably, I'm probably six. It's like 1961.
Well, who brought you? Your father?
I don't know who. My mother brought the three of us, and we're there with her, and I got an aisle seat, man.
Yeah.
And they're going to come down the aisle from the back of the theater and walk down the aisle up to the front.
Right.
And I'm waiting the Three Stooges. Man, these guys, God, the Three Stooges live. They come down and they're like 4'3".
Yeah.
They're like little Russian guys from the Lower East Side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and
that's that first letdown.
Horowitz, right? Maybe it's a Howard, but Howard was.
Oh, I wonder what his real name
was. It was something.
Yeah, probably.
But anyway, Mo was just, I was just, enamored. It was like,
Was it great seeing them live? I mean, they must have been older men by then.
Well, they were older men, but this was before Mo got into the whole fight with the Beatles about them stealing his haircut.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But the movie was horrible, but we loved it. And I remember Larry, too.
So they were just doing a bit before the movie?
Well, they came up. They came down the aisle. Everybody went crazy. The kids are going nuts.
Yeah.
They go up on stage, and they got one guy with them. Who do you think they got with them? A sound effects guy.
Oh, okay.
Like a radio sound effects
guy. Oh, really?
Guy
yeah.
With a timpani.
Yeah.
So when he would punch Curly, Joe,
boom.
Yeah. And they had a ratchet if he pulled Larry's hair. And they had a go-go thing that went boing if he would hit him in the eyes. He would hit him, and they did like 15 minutes of their vaudeville bit.
That's amazing.
And the kids went nuts, man. And then we went to see Bozo later on, and he was a dud because we said, you can't follow the Stooges, and anybody can be Bozo. It's a clown costume.
Right, right.
We don't know that we're getting the real guy. We're not going to get Larry Harmon, who years later I met, and he sent me a picture of himself. And
the
I
original
asked him,
Bozo?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Diver Dan, I met later. These guys I watched on TV, they're working regular jobs.
And it's always a weird, it can go either way when you meet the guys that you love when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah. Well, the same with Chuck Berry.
I met him briefly.
I pretty much wake up every day and forgive Chuck Berry.
You do?
Yeah, because I hear the music and I say, that's all.
He invented it.
Yeah.
For
a while, I thought maybe every time I've met him, it's just been a bad day every time.
He's just a dick? Is he a dick?
Well, he was treated badly,
for years.
He was treated badly. They put the Mann Act on him. They did everything they could to put this guy in jail because all the white girls loved him.
Right.
It was like, get rid of this guy.
Right. Yeah.
And he was pretty... he was happening. Everybody loved Chuck. And he was a poet.
His songwriting, dude.
There's not a more prolific writer.
But there's not a better rock songwriter. Because if you listen to You Can't Catch Me or something like that, where I was listening to Dylan recently. I'm like, there's no Dylan without Chuck Berry.
There isn't. Because if you the listing thing, the Maybelline, was redone by Bob a lot. Bob really,
he was on top of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's
Monkey Business is a perfect
idea.
That's
a Dylan song.
Yeah. Well,
it's
Subterranean Homesick Blues.
It is.
Yeah, it is. No, it is. It is.
I realized that later in life.
It's totally
It was definitely Monkey Business.
Yeah, Monkey Business is Subterranean. But
Bob was smarter than the Beach Boys. They just got nailed for Surfing USA. I mean, it's the exact Chuck, you know.
But it was, it's not even one of his great lyrical, you know, oddities. Like, you know, like Can't Catch Me and Too Much Monkey Business.
Yeah.
And, well, Maybelline too. Like, the Beach Boys did the easy ones.
Yeah, yeah. But Brown Eyed Handsome Man, the lyrics in that.
I love Buddy Holly's cover of that.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, yeah. And Chuck's, you know, well, yeah, he's salty and stuff, you know, but I met him a lot through when I worked with Johnny Johnson, his piano player.
Yeah.
You know, for a good 10 years, we would encounter Chuck now and then. And Johnny could put him in line because Johnny was the one guy.
Stole it from Johnny.
He was afraid of Johnny.
Johnny invented that open.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's why Chuck would only play in those fucking piano keys because Johnny was the guy.
But you know what? It's still the songwriting is, you know, I mean, it's one thing to say music because music was a communal thing and everybody was playing everybody's stuff. But when you get into Chuck's melody and lyrics, those are clearly his, you know, and it's hard to patent the blues, man.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's also got this weird thing that I didn't really realize until I watched Keith and I listened to him talk to Keith, that he's got a bounce that's not easy to do.
You know, there's some mythology involved with all this. Nobody knows. You know, when you play
the ones you played
on. Well, when I play with Keith Richard two times that I did, you know.
When was
there.
That for?
Well, we were at the Manny's, the Chicago Blues.
Yeah.
On 12th Street, which is where Greenwich runs right into Hudson.
What year was this?
Oh, I'm going to guess 94, 5, you know. And
what, he was just hanging out?
I was playing with Johnny, and we walked in with Johnny Johnson. And I walked in, and I look over to the side, of sitting there with a, you know, drink, orange juice and vodka, is Keith Richard.
Yeah.
And he's there. He's like, hey, mate, I'm here to play with Johnny, right? I said, oh, fucking yeah, you are. That's great. He went downstairs, came downstairs. I had a 350 like Chuck's.
Yeah.
I'd let him play. He picked that. I had a 50 Strat, and he said, well, I'm not going to play that when you have that Chuck guitar there.
Right,
and he played the Chuck Berry 350 all night, took his shirt off, you know, just played.
Did he nail it?
Oh, he was great.
Yeah?
Oh, he was so... I had never been in that car before.
Yeah.
You know?
And
with him driving.
Like?
You're done, man. It's like standing next to B.B. King or anybody else. Heavy.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He drives the band.
He does.
The band has to be... You can't ignore the groove coming. It's all there. He doesn't really... You know, I think he hooks up with Charlie.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that, you
right.
know? Right. And he demands... he demands your attention, you know, and
but like when you say that, because you're like, you know, by nature, or not by nature, but by occupation, you know, outside of you know what you're doing now, you're a band leader now, and you're always sort of a secret band leader, but you're a backup guy.
Well, yeah, and I tell you though, the secret about two guitars, of course, is somebody's going to be taking the wheel, and that's going to be Keith in this case, and then you're going to find the other part. You're not going to play his stuff
because you can't.
Well, no, it's just not good music. You know?
I know, but it's weird because Keith
has a thing. He talks about the weaving of two guitars in his book,
and he
talks about.
I know,
and it either works or it doesn't work.
But you knew that going in.
I didn't. The book wasn't written yet, but I knew from.
You got to follow
situations,
him. You got to find your holes.
There's another part, and it's not the part he's playing.
But he'll leave it open. I mean,
there's plenty
of space there.
It's there. When you find it, you get a smile from him. If you don't find it, he'll come right up in your face.
Really?
You know? Well, guys will attack you, man. Jack Bruce, I played with Jack Bruce one day, right? And he just comes up like he wants to have a knife fight with you, you know?
It's so weird because as a listener, unless you're very astute, you're not really going to pick up just how on top of it these guys are. See, that's the weird mythology of the fan versus the musician, is that you can listen to Keith all day and think like, well, that, you know, it's a little messy. And it's oddly, you know, he makes odd timing choices, but he's completely on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, just listen to Can't You Hear Me Knocking, you're done, man.
So when did you start playing, when did you drop the trumpet and why?
Is there really a why?
No, but I mean, it's
well,
like...
Well, I played trumpet,
was it limiting? I mean, did you not feel you could push yourself through the trumpet?
My father played trumpet. I always wanted to because I could never be as good as him on the horn, or my brother Jerry on the sax.
Plays in Conan's band with you.
Yeah, who's just a genius player.
Do you guys get along?
Oh, yeah, we get along, but he never takes the horn out of his mouth.
Right.
And he's practicing 24 hours a day, trying to still hone his craft.
Really?
You know? And I was always like, okay, let me get this I learned trumpet, and then I learned to arrange for big band. By the time I was like 14 or 15 and 7th grade.
You could
grade,
write music.
7th grade, I was arranging for the big band in high school.
Really?
You know? Yeah. So I was
so
writing,
that was your thing. You could break it down. You could take a piece of Stan Kelton music
Yeah,
or
Stan
something.
Kenton and Buddy Stan Rich Kenton. And stuff. And, yeah. I started like reading Downbeat, and there would be transcriptions in the back looking.
How'd you learn how to read music?
From trumpet.
Yeah.
But then one of my teachers gave me the Walter Piston book about the orchestration and, you know, and about practical ranges of instruments. And I read the book front to cover like 10 times.
So you were fascinated with the whole thing.
I was fascinated.
The whole thing.
I couldn't do math for shit.
Right.
But this, which was math, and I wasn't connecting that it was math,
right,
was beautiful. In front of a piano, I could figure out chord voicings and stuff and you know, and started transcribing things, records, Zappa records, you know, Beefheart records.
So you're 15, you figure out how to write the music, you're going to see all these rock bands.
Yeah, and then I got an organ. I said, shit, man.
M4 or whatever?
No, my friend had a Vox Supercontinental.
Was that what they were called, the M4?
I had an M3. I got an M3 eventually, which is what Booker T played, only on Green Onions, but still, that was before the B. So first I got a Farfisa, you know, a combo compact. From my uncle's son didn't want to play anymore. He was going to become an electrician, join the family business. So we all tried. So I got that Farfisa, and then I, you know, started playing organ.
Right.
And then got hooked on Al Kooper and all that, you know, and Phyllis Cavalieri and Steve
Winwood. From Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Yeah, Al is like my best friend in the world now, you know.
Is he all right?
Yeah, he's great. And Felix is another good friend of mine from the Rascals. And then there was Winwood, who, those three guys were...
Those
my
are your guys?
Favorite guys. You
yeah.
Know? So he goes Winwood from, and all three from their vocal standpoint, too. I love the way they all sang. Different. So then I started playing organ in bands and then got the
what
M3.
Bands?
Just local, you know, just little bands with my brother. I always had horns because I'd be writing for the horns.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we always had.
With Jerry,
yeah.
And Floyd's off doing his
thing. He's off like somewhere playing honky-tonk piano up in the Catskills or something. Yeah. And they're playing in the Jewish mountains, right? He's up there playing in, you know, whatever, you know. And so we're just playing rock. We're playing like rock and roll and soul around,
right.
You know.
Around Jersey?
Yeah, around Jersey. Up and down the coast you could play. You know, we're opening for, it's like 74... you know, we're opening for bands like Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes are coming in from Philly. And before they're famous, you know, we used to sit for 6 months at a time in Pequannock on Route 23.
Right.
Up there where you're talking about.
Yeah.
Your people are from. And so we were the house band. So Chubby Checker, the Platters.
And you just back
they'd all come through and we back them all up. You know, and Fred Parris and the Five Satins, I got to know all these guys, doo-wop guys.
And they'd come in with arrangements and just lay them on you?
Sometimes just a guitar player saying, here's how it goes, you know? That was it. And how dare you not know these songs,
if you can't get through the twist.
And I'm playing, I'm playing organ and bass at the same time now, you know, so I have to know the songs.
Right.
But
that was back when they still had supper clubs around, right?
Yeah.
The big rooms that were built for big bands.
Yeah. So then I decided at one point, after maybe 4 years of doing that, I said, oh man, I'm like 23 now. I want to play guitar. I always had a guitar. So I stopped gigging and just went back to work doing carpentry, spackling, sheetrocking, you know, practicing guitar.
Okay.
And then got with a show band. This was the best. Andre and Sorrell. Okay, everywhere around Jersey, there's a band that's like Martin and Lewis.
Right.
A comedian and a singer.
Right.
Handsome singer, funny-looking comedian.
Yeah.
So, and we're playing the lounges in Jersey.
Right.
You know, the Goomba lounges, really. And coming in after us, or the week before, is Joe Pesci and Frankie Vincent and their band.
Yeah.
You know, Joe Pesci was a guitar player.
Really?
Yeah, and Frank Vincent, I think, was the drummer. That's the guy he kills in every movie.
No, I know. They're great. They're great, but they were a comedy team.
They're a comedy team. They were like a Martin and Lewis. You know, handsome guy, funny guy.
That was the way it worked.
Yeah, and we had Andre and Sorrell, and these guys were all friends.
And you were just backing them?
So I lost myself in a show band for like a year. Playing guitar.
Just backing those
two? Just backing up whoever, whatever we did, you know, and so learn to play guitar, because I'd practice all day long. We'd be on the road in West Virginia for 3 weeks.
What were you practicing? What did you use to practice then? What were you trying to figure out?
I was just really everything I could get my hands on. Every cassette I had with me. You know, a lot of times it was Charlie Christian, and at the same time, a Jeff Beck group, you know. T-Bone Walker Heavy,
yeah.
Muddy Waters. And I fell in love with Guitar Slim, who was a guy down in New Orleans. Yeah. You know, Things I Used to Do.
No Freddie or Albert yet?
Freddie was essential.
Yeah.
Albert was what Hendrix was coming from. You know, you could hear all that bending
and
stuff.
And Buddy Guy.
Yeah, well, Buddy too.
Yeah.
But something about Freddie, those records, you know, Freddie King sings.
The instrumentals.
Yeah, and Freddie King plays, yeah. You know, and yeah. Freddie King plays and sings.
Hideaway.
Hideaway.
Yeah.
Dance Away, that right. Hideaway Dance Away album.
Yeah.
And then Freddie King sings.
Yeah.
Where he does the Bobby Bland thing. Yeah. You know, he got Bobby Bland.
It's interesting that the transition from those records into the Leon Russell produced things.
Yeah, which
Shelter,
aren't my favorites.
They're not very good.
No, those King records are the shit. Man.
Right.
And then there was a TV
show. Same with
show.
The James Brown King records
yeah.
are great.
Yeah, there was a TV show called The Beat.
Yeah.
If you can find it, you can look online
mm-hmm.
and just do Freddie King The Beat and watch what comes up. And you'll be astounded at the great how great they shot him playing. You can learn so much from
really?
That. Really? Though, if you have The Beat, like the whole box set of The Beat, or just watch him online, you'll be a better guitar player.
I'm just like, I don't have a knack to pick up shit. You know, like, you'll show me shit if I go to Conan. You'll
yeah,
show me
yeah,
a couple
that's
things.
All we do. That's really why you come.
Yeah, just so I can play your guitars and you can show me two things.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you show me a good thing, I'm like, oh, I'm going to figure, you know, I'm just going to play that over and over
but
again.
But you'll always do something and I say, shit, that's cool.
No, come on.
I wouldn't do that. Listen, your vibrato's better than mine, man.
Oh, come
so,
on.
So, you know, that's good. It must be from the girls, man. I don't know.
I don't know. You know, either
it's
you got
a finger.
But either you got to feel or you don't. You
no,
know what
you
I mean?
Can either guys do that or they don't.
Because you know, Brendan Small came in here and I was doing blues shit. And he's like, you got the vibrato. I'm like, is that a hard thing? Like,
oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I didn't know that was something. But then I paid attention to it. And there's some footage I watched of Eric Clapton showing the difference between his sad vibrato and then his rock vibrato.
Oh, you know that great Spinal Tap one from
right.
the... Where he talks about the woman tone and the
right,
wah-wah.
That's right. Yeah, that was
it's
it.
It's very cool, though. It's very Spinal Tap, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you want to mock it, but like he seemed to believe it. And
no,
I
he did believe he was right. Look, there's nobody who has more right to play the blues than Eric Clapton.
No, that's right, but like he was yeah. never really my guy. Like after John Mayall, maybe two Cream songs, yeah. I was done.
Well, he got so down on himself, but you know,
he got insecure.
Yeah, I don't know. He didn't want to believe what people were saying about him.
Right, it's
but
it was a
heavy, true. Nobody
heavy
was
burden,
better.
Man.
Nobody was better. He was spooked by Hendrix, you know.
Everybody
and,
was.
Yeah. But really, Eric had something totally
it's
different.
It's weird. All those Brits, they got spooked by Hendrix and then got spooked by the band.
Yeah, like the Clapton, band broke up more bands, you know.
It was weird because Clapton...
They stopped the British blues dead in its track.
Why?
The Beatles, even.
Yeah.
You know, you hear the Beatles, you know, trying to do All Things Must Pass during the Let It Be sessions. There's some bootlegs.
That was post-band.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're trying to be the band.
Yeah.
You know,
what was it about the band that made them so crazy?
Pete
Townsend too.
Pete
yeah.
Townsend's demo, it's on the Lighthouse box of "Won't Get Fooled Again." Is Shameless Levon Helm? He's playing drums too, and you know he took it to the Who apparently and said, "I want you to play it like this." And Keith was like, "No fucking way!"
Yeah,
you know.
But what was it about the band that everybody was so jealous of?
Well, the fact that A, they were Dylan's guys.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
And B. Nobody had ever played any music like that as a band before.
Uh-huh,
you know, it's rooted in everything gospel and George Jones and Ray Charles.
It's like pure American music.
Yeah, yeah, it's all American. It was nothing. There was nothing English about it,
and no one
and
ever heard
it. Wasn't
that
really the blues.
No,
you know,
no,
except that Richard was the blues,
right?
His singing, you know.
Yeah,
but it was the gospel aspect of piano and organ. Just think at the same time, the piano and the organ.
Yeah.
Procol Harum had that sound, but it didn't sound like that.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like at a church.
Well, somehow or another, Garth was able to capture an Americana.
Garth is a carnival.
Right. Exactly.
He's a carnival.
And to integrate that into rock music, I don't think anybody ever really
Garth played organ in his uncle's you know, funeral home.
I think that was it. The weird mix of all those guys and where they came from and what was important to them. Because I fucking, like, all of them singing outside of Robbie or Garth, but like Richard, Rick, and Levon, it's like, you can't beat those fucking voices.
Yeah, where do you get, only the Beatles had three lead singers.
Yeah.
And it worked for the Beatles.
Right.
But even then, I think that that mostly Paul and George were impressed with the band. John wasn't impressed. You know, John was, nothing was bigger than the Beatles to John, never, right. ever would be.
Even John.
You know, even John. Right. No, I mean, he admittedly was like, you know, that
well,
he wouldn't
pretty,
be impressed by anything.
It's pretty astounding.
Even Dylan, he outdid Dylan in a lot of ways. He took Dylan's thing, like, you know, almost stole, Norwegian Wood is almost, is Bob Dylan's one of the Dream songs.
Yeah.
Almost, you know, almost note for note, but.
Yeah.
Bob wouldn't say anything about that.
Right,
you know,
right.
Because Bob got it from Woody and
right.
wouldn't want to open that door.
Yeah, Bob got it from Woody and Ramblin' Jack.
Yeah, right, right. You don't want to open that door. There's a certain amount of you know, communal sharing.
Sure.
That's
well,
allowed.
I mean, but it's also like, you know, people have to try on, you know, they have to sort of appropriate the drive of somebody else in
sure.
order to get to where they're going.
Yeah, yeah. And even the Beatles got that from, you know, from, well, they got it, first of all, from Elvis
Brothers.
And Little Richard and the
yeah.
Everly Brothers.
Yeah. Sorry, so you're playing behind comedy
yeah,
teams.
Yeah, right. So then, and then I'm just playing guitar now.
Yeah.
And then I at one point I said, man, I gotta get to New York. You know,
Gotta get out of Jersey.
I'm working like crazy. I'm making money as a musician.
Yeah.
But I'm not getting anywhere, you know, and I go and I start hanging out at JP's, you know, up in 78th Street, wherever it is up there on First Avenue.
And what was that?
Everybody's hanging out there. Harry Nilsson's there. You know, Dave Mason's there. Yeah. We're all misbehaving. Kennedy Juniors are up there. You know, everybody's
doing the schniz.
Everybody's hanging out. We go yeah. in the basement. You
yeah.
know, a guy, you know, comes down.
Yeah,
we drink all night. We get yeah. leave at 5 a.m. with our spring, our sunglasses with us.
Yeah.
When we start drinking, you know.
Right.
And started meeting people. And I met a band there. That was backing up Kitty Bruce, Lenny's daughter at the
mm-hmm.
time.
What was she doing?
And she was singing.
Uh-huh.
And then Al Cooper came in, and he was going to grab that band. I was playing with that band. And
who else was in it?
Nobody you would know. Nobody you would know. All Jersey guys.
Yeah.
So. And we would come in, and and Al says, like, sorry, I can't use you, man, because you do the same thing I do. You play organ and guitar.
Yeah.
So
this is Al Cooper. So at that time,
so we became
Blood, Sweat,
friends.
And Tears is done.
Yeah, and he's done some solo touring, and he's produced Lynyrd Skynyrd by now, and
so he's
and produced the Tubes.
He's got some bread.
Yeah, he's done some stuff. He's moving around. He was in Atlanta for a while. He was in L.A.
All right, Al Cooper.
So I meet Al Cooper, and I couldn't work with him, but at the same time, we hooked up with Phoebe Snow, so I was working with Phoebe because Al wasn't in that situation. So they were sharing a band, kind of, Phoebe and Al. Phoebe was like a big influence. She taught me to play acoustic blues. You know, she really learned from Bromberg.
Yeah.
Her and Bromberg were
friends.
He's
another guy I never got.
Yeah. Well, it was great at sitting down. You know, Bromberg you know, was just great at sitting down and playing porch blues, acoustic blues. You
know, I gotta fucking revisit that
Stephon
shit.
Grossman, those guys, you know, Stephen Bishop, they were all around.
Stephen Bishop?
Yeah, you know, they were all around at the same time. They were all folk singers and blues, folk and blues.
Yeah.
You know, and so then I started working with Phoebe. It's weird. And then I had to stop and started working with Al, too. Because Al said, put a band together for me, and I did.
Al would take the front, and he would sing and play piano?
Yeah, he'd sing and play piano.
Mostly Blood, Sweat, and Tears stuff?
All of his stuff.
Yeah.
Just a big catalog of stuff. And then at the same time, I'm working at The Bottom Line with my brother Floyd doing live shows.
Yeah.
And Alan Pepper, who owns The Bottom Line, says, I got this idea to do a show. I see you come in here, you organize things, you put bands together. I want to do a show with Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, their music, and I want to bring you together with Paul Schaefer, who was maybe now 2 years into the Letterman show, out of Saturday Night Live.
Is he a wizard?
He's great.
Yeah.
He's my mentor. He's the
Paul.
Guy that nobody knows what a great musician he is.
He obviously,
you know, they
is.
Know the character.
Well, yeah, but, he became one.
You know,
but...
you know, there was a guy named Oscar Levant.
Yeah, yeah, the piano player.
Who was a brilliant piano player. But more people knew him as an eccentric comedian. But he was still a
motherfucker. Ben Stiller was going to do a movie about him.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah, he's great to watch.
You know, and Jose Iturbe was another one.
Yeah.
These brilliant players.
Yeah.
But they also, and Liberace, they had these personalities.
Right.
Paul's like a combination of those three guys, you know, and Jerry Lee Lewis.
Great ear,
so,
right?
Yeah, and Jerry Lee Lewis, yeah. The way the flamboyant
sure.
thing, you know, and Elton John a bit. But
he can do all of those. That's
just
what makes him different.
Just a great.
Like, he can interpret anything.
He taught me about how to listen to records from the bottom up.
Like, what does that mean?
Well, how to find out what makes a record.
Right.
The rhythm section. You start with the bass and drums. And you get that right, you can build on that. But
right.
you can't, arrange a record from the top with the strings and horns.
Yeah.
None of that's important. He says, all that window dressing is fine, and he knew that I could do that.
Yeah.
So he was going to help me doing the rhythm arrangements for this show with Darlene Love and all these great people that ran called Leader of the Pack at the bottom line. So that got me, and me and Paul became great friends and still are since then. We're just record heads, you know. Yeah. And quotes, you know, and just he introduced me to Phil Spector and just all
what
these
was that
great,
like?
It was the bizarre evening.
What happened?
Well,
where
you know,
were you?
That we were in. We went to PJ Clark's, I guess it's called, right? Something like that. A steakhouse. Yeah. Where that's where
out here.
Where, no, in New York. Yeah. He calls me up. He says, "Phil's in town. You should come." So I said, "All right." And I go to see Phil and Paul, and I meet with Paul, and Paul's there. It's the funniest story. Paul had two friends. He had done Viva Shake Vegas, you know, his show in Vegas. So he knew some dancers from Vegas that were in town, and two of those girls were at the table, and me and Paul. So it was four of us at the table waiting for Phil to show up. It was friendly, totally. It wasn't anything, you know.
Yeah.
There was nothing about it, but just from so Phil comes, and he's got two big bodyguards with him, right?
Yeah.
And Phil. And
he's
looks,
a little guy.
He's a little guy, and he looks, and he gives you the fish handshake, you know?
Yeah.
And he looks around. He looks at me and Paul, and he looks at the two girls, and he whispers to one of the big guys. The guy runs out to make a phone call.
Yeah.
Within 20 minutes, two hookers show up for Phil. Because he's like, "You have girls. Now I have girls."
Yeah.
You
know? Really? Interesting.
And it was funny as hell, man.
Yeah.
And so we had steaks, and then it was going to continue, and it was getting a little drunky and a little bit passive aggressive.
With Phil.
Yeah. So I went home.
Yeah.
Because I had heard some other stories about going out, and I didn't want to be in that.
You want to be in the crossfire of some weird shit?
I was just impressed to be in his presence.
Did he talk music at all?
Yeah, we did, about the Blind Boys of Alabama, about some, you know, gospel groups, and just he loved all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
We don't, you don't talk to people about their music.
Right.
You know, if I'm with Jimmy Page or something, or Robert Plant's in the room, we talk about Howlin' Wolf. We have a common ground.
Yeah.
If you talk about someone's music to them, the wall immediately goes up.
Uh-huh.
You know, you are all of a sudden, you're a fan. You can't be a fan to people.
Not if you're a musician.
You know? No. And even with comedy, I mean, if you're, you know, you don't, if you were hanging out with Steve Martin, would you talk about his bits? Hey, remember you did that bit? You know,
it depends.
You know, I mean.
Like, because I do that with you. I mean, like, you know, you're going to show me that riff. You know
I ain't
I mean?
Steve Martin, though.
But then again, I'm not a musician, so I'm allowed to be a music fan.
Yeah.
So like when I talk to musicians in here, like if I talk to Booker T, I'm going to talk to him for 2 hours about his music.
Yeah.
And it's going to be okay. Because
well, I mean, I can talk to you about Mitch Hedberg. You
right.
Know?
Sure.
I can in the underground world.
But comedy's different. It's like there's no history behind a joke, but a piece of produced music. You know, some of those things got the biggest stories in the world.
Well, yeah, that's true. But there's always the Milton Berle thing about who did he steal from? And, you know.
No, but still, like if I talk to John Cale, I'm like, what about those Stooges records? He's like, well, he said to me, he said, they were all set.
He
took that gig just because no one else wanted to do it in a way.
Yeah, they were ready to go.
Yeah,
it just turned the machine on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that astounded me.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought, like, what does a producer bring to this? Well, with them, not much.
Well, I had a conversation with Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
And here's what I said to Ringo Starr. Because I said, what did it feel like to be in the biggest band in England, and then take a step down and join the Beatles? You know? Because that's the truth. Rory Storm and the Hurricanes were the biggest band in England. They were like wild, crazy, you know?
Yeah.
He says, well, the Beatles paid me more money. But, you know, it was fun. It's fun to not, you know, you want to push
keep
that
cool
button.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to push that fan button with anybody, really. You know, your wall goes up, you know.
Sure, sure.
And you want to, you can't know somebody, you know, you find common ground.
So you and Al Kooper, like,
so
you lock in.
So me and Al Kooper, we locked in, and we still love each other. And then after that, I...
How long were you with him, though?
Oh, I'm still with him. I just did his 70th birthday in New York. We did three nights, two nights in at B.B. King's and one in Albany.
But didn't you spend a lot of time, you know, just working with him almost exclusively?
Never.
No?
Never. And then, so I was doing Phoebe and him, and then I stopped doing both to do the Broadway show, which went from the bottom line to Broadway.
Yeah.
And that put like a halt on things.
And you were arranging it as well?
Yeah, conducting, arranging. But then I wasn't really into that. And once the show stopped,
yeah,
I went back to playing. I played with a band called Reckless Sleepers with Jules Scheer, Steve Holly, and we recorded on IRS Records. You know, we made one album.
Uh-huh.
And at that time...
But you had no dream of being a pop music act?
No, and then my friend... Then I went out with... to work on a TV show out here.
So you always consider yourself a studio musician, a working musician.
A working musician, that's all I ever wanted to be, was Tommy Tedesco, you know? That's all I ever wanted to be. Yeah. So anyway, then I'm doing that. I'm doing a lot of different stuff. And
what TV show did you do out here?
Out here, I came to do two pilots for a show called Deja Vu.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was John Sebastian was going to be the host. So I met John Sebastian. Felix Cavalieri was there. NRBQ was there. And Ronnie Spector and Peter Noon, I was there.
Yeah.
You know, MDing for most of the bands.
Yeah.
And then playing with NRBQ with Felix and John.
Right.
And that's when I met John. And we became like just great friends again. You know, we started a jug band together. We just kept working together. Through all these people, I met Laura Nero then through Felix and John and started working with Laura and produced a record with her and was on the road for like 3 years with her. And then the Conan gig came in 93 because somewhere in that, you know, I had worked with Max on something called Killer Joe, a project, after the E Street Band got fired.
So he brought you in as a...
He brought me in as a guitar player, and my brother was in the band, and the guitar player wasn't happening. He said, call my brother.
Yeah.
So Max called me, and then we got along great.
You and Max did?
Yeah, we worked great in that band together, and then...
How's he at arranging?
Well, he's a great drummer.
Right. Did you do most of the arranging?
Well, I was always the arranger. That was never hidden, you know.
Yeah.
It was always my job. And so I was at this point playing with Clarence and living in, you know, in 92.
Clarence Clemens.
I had a band with Clarence living in at his house in Sausalito when Max called me and said, I got an audition and we got to put the band back together because I told him we have a band. So you got to come home, but don't tell Clarence because he'll get, all he has to do is call and he has the gig.
Right.
He was such a dynamic personality.
Yeah, yeah. What were you doing with him?
With just the Clarence Clemens band, you know?
Yeah, that was you?
Yeah, I was after the hits, you know? Yeah. Just like, we're just getting it together. And then I left and I came home here to New York. I left because I had worked on Sister Act 1 and 2 in with Whoopi.
Yeah.
And Mark Shaman, my friend, and did a lot of movie work with him out here. And I was going to move out here. Working in movies seemed fine. In TV, and I had done a soul session with James Brown for Cinemax. And Legendary Ladies of Rock and Roll. So I was working on TV and...
You played with all these guys.
And movies. Yeah, with Wilson Pickett and, you know...
Did you?
We had Pickett and James Brown and Aretha and Joe Cocker and Robert Palmer all on one show. And Billy Vera and Pickett we had to record the night before.
Yeah.
Because we get to Detroit. We had to go to Detroit because my friend Joel Gallen, who managed Felix Cavalieri when I worked with Felix... Then got with Sid Vintage, who was a video producer out here, and started doing these things. And then he sort of spearheaded the Unplugged thing later for MTV, Joel, and did really well with that. But meanwhile, he's just starting out, and he calls me up, he says, Jimmy, remember when you told me if I ever work with James Brown that you would carry guitars? Well, I need you to come in and do arrangements for this show. I said, and he said, and I'll carry your guitar, and I'll give you $500. And I said, all right, get me to Detroit. So I had to do charts, and I had to teach James Brown's band, this is great, to play all this music, other people's music. James Brown's band, really, they don't really read, you know?
Right.
The horn players could read some.
Right.
So I wrote horn charts. I had charts, and I had to take them through you know, and they learned really fast, man. They were really, and I had both drummers going, you know, it was great. I had to do it. And then James, I turn around and somebody taps me on the shoulders. Mr. Brown wants to speak to you. So I go down there, and there he is. He's dressed like, he's got a scarf, a green jumpsuit on, you know. His hair is coiffed, his sunglasses on, you know.
Yeah.
And he says, I got to lean into him, right?
Yeah.
How come you got two drummers playing? Two drummers don't play at the same time. I said, oh, I didn't know that, Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
He says, well, I'll let it go, but not in my band, not with my music. Because he said, it sounds good. So, and they were playing Addicted to Love, and it was killing me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And with Robert Palmer, and all these guys are going nuts that they get to sing with James Brown's band.
Right.
James Brown, I'm not sure if he likes the idea of his band backing other people up.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And this is a secret process that only he gets to do with them.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
And then the best was, so Joe Cocker comes, and he says, meet me the day before. I got to figure out what key, Joe. You know, you're going to sing When a Man Loves a Woman. So he goes, well, meet me in the bar. You know?
Yeah.
And then we had to get some heavy drinking boots on, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was a piano in the bar. We got around to the piano like 3 a.m. I'm playing, well, a man. He goes, higher. Well, a man. He goes, higher. I said, how are you going to know when it's the right key? He says, when it hurts.
Yeah.
I'll know I'm in the right key.
Really?
And then he's doing it, and he killed it, man.
Yeah.
He was really sweet. I loved him, man. Man, could that guy sing.
Right.
And Billy Vera, I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah.
He was there to sing Out of Sight, you know, and he was thrilled. He's such a music, you know, nut, such a musicologist.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like a professor about this shit, man.
So when did you, like all this time, you're doing arrangements on records as well?
Yeah, whatever, you know, whatever work.
It seemed like you never stopped working.
Yeah, all I wanted to do was work. I didn't want to ever be an artist,
right.
You know? I didn't.
But when did you start tracking down these old blues guys?
Well, that happened through the Lone Star Cafe back then. I used to work there. And
in the 80s?
In the 80s. And, like, I would back up Benny King, you know?
Yeah.
And
I saw Bo Diddley there almost.
Yeah, I backed up Bo, and I played organ with Bo at the time a while back, you know? And then, you know, I was would work with... Mike Merritt came in. He was working with Johnny Copeland at the time.
Uh-huh.
He was playing bass with me still. Mike and James Wormworth was the drummer. And they had a tour coming with Johnny Johnson. So I started working in that band. And that was the real learning point of the blues. Even though I had seen Muddy when I was a kid, and he would let me up on stage and might play with Pine Top, you know.
You did?
I'd ply those guys with alcohol, you know. What are you drinking?
Where was that at?
Opened like the Show Place in Dover,
okay.
New Jersey. My friend was their road manager.
Okay.
You know, that I went to high school
with.
So
you played with Muddy?
Well, only piano, you know, some piano,
yeah.
You know, but the presence of him backstage, and he was so nice all the time, you know. And so I would start going to see these guys when they come around, you know, any of them.
The Lone Star used to put a lot of them on.
Yeah, and then I got to play with Pine Top, and I got to play with
Willie
Johnny
Dixon.
Johnson, and I never played with Willie. You know, I played with Junior Wells. I played with,
sober?
He was great. Oh, he was the best.
Yes.
Never sober. We've discovered now, though, that me and my couple of my friends are the new old guys, and there's no old guys left. The old guys that we saw weren't that old, you know, when we saw them.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys didn't live too long.
So, all right, so Max pulls you in.
Well, he pulled me in, and then we did an audition, and it turns out that Jeff Ross, you know, that's not Jeffrey Ross,
right.
Or not Jeff Ross, the other Jeff
the
Ross.
Producer, yeah.
Yeah, there's like three Jeff Rosses out there that we know. But Jeff Ross was the road manager for Diana Ross.
Is that true?
Yes. That's funny that they used to call him Mr. Ross, but he wasn't really. But in the band, in Diana's touring band, was Pender and La Bamba.
Yeah.
So when we walk in, he sees them, and it's like almost a done deal.
Yeah.
You know? Of course... I'm not sure Robert Smigel was involved. Robert Smigel was a producer also at
the first show, on the first season, yeah.
So he loved us too, you know, and Conan loved it. So, you know, there might have been one guy that wanted, you know, the Lounge Lizards, you know, and John Lurie's band. But,
right.
You know, it turns out that John Lurie anyway did okay because he actually wrote the first theme, you know.
He did?
Well, yeah, but yeah.
Of the Conan O'Brien show?
Yeah, a person whose name will be unnamed right now. What do I care?
Yeah.
So I might as well say this. What can happen?
Nothing.
Nothing can happen. So I'm, you know, we get the gig.
Right.
You know, Howard Shore, who was Lorne's buddy.
Right.
And, you know, an Academy Award winning, you know, orchestra, rather a composer.
Right.
Composer.
Yeah.
Was Saturday Night Live, you know, MD for a long time and wrote everything up there.
Right.
He says, all right, well, I wrote a theme, you know. I wrote a theme. Me and Max put a theme together. And he says, I'm going to write the theme. I'm going to write.
That's a fucking paycheck forever.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to write the theme. Yeah. So the very first idea I hear is our idea of bass and drums going, do, 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 do. I said, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And then I hear the other part. You know, I hear the other, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that. So, well, that's interesting. It's very Thelonious Monk-like. It's very cool.
Yeah.
So, but I was getting, he would fax me at the time. We were still on fax machines in 94, 93.
Yeah.
Oh, here's a little bit, and then put them all together, and then we put the whole thing together. I said, wow, it's amazing the way this guy works. He just keeps feeding me little bits and putting them together like a puzzle, and then we got this amazing piece out of it.
Yeah.
Boy, he writes weird.
Yeah.
The show's going on for about 6 weeks. Jeff Ross calls me into the office and says, we got a problem.
Yeah.
John Lurie called me. He says, that's his theme. So I said, well, simply, let's look at John Lurie's audition tape. And there it is. Boom. Note for note.
No shit.
There it is.
Wow.
The theme.
Yeah.
The whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the answer was, well, I always intended to pay him and split it.
Oh, man.
Ends up, Lurie didn't get the gig, but he got a lot of bread out of the
For the first, what, 10 years?
Well, you know, for the first 16 years.
So he did all right.
He did okay, John did, yeah. Without having to put up, you know, without having to actually come to work. But I'll tell you, it's a funny story, you know?
I mean, but that seems
It's so lazy to do that, you know? He may have intended to bring
criminal.
John in.
Who the hell knows?
But John had to call and say, what's up? You know, and it wasn't my job to research the song.
Right, right.
So anyway, it all turned out that, you know, John got half of his song anyway.
Oh, good.
So half of something is better than all or nothing.
He seems like you don't want to fuck with that guy. He's a cranky guy.
And he's in those Jarmusch movies, right? He's in like Mystery Train and
I see him on Twitter. I want to interview him, but he's in New York and
Remember the fishing show he had too?
Yeah, yeah. No, I love the guy. I love the Lounge Wizards.
Oh yeah,
it's a good.
And
a good
thing. Steve Bernstein's a friend of mine who was in that band and part of that downtown scene.
What do you want to play?
I'll play a song. We'll debut a song of mine that hasn't been.
Can I handle it?
Yeah, sure you can. It's like a Jimmy Reed
fills?
Song.
All right,
except
good.
There's one little thing. It's a you can play the fills. You'd be the second guy. A.
I'm an A.
Yeah. Right. Sometime you need a little something, then you need a little something more. Nothing you can buy at your five and dime or your local convenience store. You got a itching for it. You got a itching for it, boy. You got a itching for something. Itching you just can't scratch. Shine. Might be a little railroad gin. Might be a little bit of China white off of a boat that just come in. You got a itching for it. You got a itching for it. You got a itching for something, boy. Itching you just can't scratch. Sometime you do a little evil, then you call your back door friend. Every time her husband's slipping out, you go sliding in. You got a itching for it. Yes, you got a itching for it. Man, you got a itching for something, child.
Man, you just can't scratch it. Scratch one out for me. Go.
Fun.
So now you're the band leader, you're the guy.
Yeah.
And was that like when you take a gig like that, like, you know, you do all those years on the old show and then he brings you in to be the Tonight Show band, that must have been like, now I'm the Tonight Show band.
Yeah.
And then he keeps you in the loop, and now you're the band leader and the star of the show. As a lifetime musician, this is a great gig.
Well, I mean, to work 20 years at anything in this business,
yeah,
and then find out you got more time coming,
yeah,
it's nice, and yeah. And you know, the rude awakening that we all received,
yeah.
And for the man who I would be ever feel like a brother, Conan, to rally. Like a father from a big Irish family.
Right,
everything's
right.
Going to be okay, kid. Yeah. I think he saw his father in this same situation in life,
uh-huh.
And felt all of us as family and treated us that way. And he said to me when it happened, he said, so you're going to hear something before it happened, but I want you to know you're going to hear something in a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
I want you to know everything's going to be okay.
Uh-huh.
You know, and we're doing the right thing.
Right.
You know, and we are now. I think we're like a little commune up on the hill,
right.
You know, growing our own food,
right.
Hunting our own deer or whatever we're doing. Maybe we're vegetarians, you know. Uh-huh. Maybe we have Birkenstock sandals. I don't know. But we're looking down into the valley and watching the idiots war and kill each other in the networks.
Yeah.
You know, scrambling like chickens without heads, not knowing what's happening. And you and I know the landscape is drastically changing, and we're
sure.
Trying to stay on top of that. With social media and everything else that's happening, you know, and we, you know, we're allowed to do this. Me and you can be here doing this in this country, you know, and we don't care about the corporate suits anymore. They're not breathing down our necks here.
Yeah.
And we felt that at Universal. When we were over there and moved to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Those guys were lurking like slime on the walls.
Yeah.
Then,
you know,
every day.
Yeah.
Second guessing every move we made.
Yeah.
Sucking all the funny out.
Right.
You know, and trying to make us common.
It made him tense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
it made everything
tense.
You know, and we're just coming around from that knockout punch.
Sure.
You know?
You guys are doing great. And you still go out and play and do your shit.
Yeah. And you know, there's one more chapter that the most important thing that happened to me was the time I spent in Woodstock and being neighbors with Levon Helm.
Uh-huh.
You know, and right when he got sick, I went over there every day that I could and hang out with
he
him.
He had throat cancer?
Yeah, and I was there doing a, I was up doing one of the Happy Traums, instructional videos with Johnny Johnson on Boogie Woogie Piano. We were taping it, and Levon heard Johnny was in town. He came over, and he had just gotten from his first radiation. His neck was like red,
yeah,
with aloe dripping from it. The steam was still coming off of
yeah.
him. He just wanted to meet Johnny Johnson. And he said to me, Jimmy V, and he named me Jimmy V because Vivino was a name that wasn't coming out of his Arkansas mouth. Uh-huh. You know, it's Vivano, Vivino. Yeah, yeah. So finally just called me Jimmy V, and that's from then I'm still, you know, yeah. still that.
Yeah.
And he said, you ought to bring Johnny over to the barn and bring a truck up and bring a truck up and record him while we're up here, you know? And I did. And I rented
with Levon
a piano
on drums?
At Levon, Rick played, Garth played. Richard Bell played.
Danko played?
Yeah, they're all gone, you know, and Johnny Johnson played. And
what album's that?
I'm still sitting on it.
How's it sound?
It's 15 years ago. I'm thinking of putting it out now.
How's it sound?
It sounds great.
Holy shit.
I cut 27 tracks or something.
Who sang? Everybody?
Well, it's mostly my record. It's my record, but Rick and I and Limon did some backups, and Rick did most of the vocals with me. And Johnny Johnson, we did it basically because Johnny was there. Then I came back again. We did two sessions in October of 99.
Uh-huh.
And I 15 years now, I've been sitting on it because guys were dropping one by one.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't put this out. I can't be one of those posthumous guys, like, you know, because somebody died, something comes out. Now
yeah.
it's been a long time for all of them. And
I put it out now out of respect.
Yeah, I'm going to put it out
right.
now. I'm going to put it out now. I'm working on it now.
Now, out of all the guys you played with, you were. What was the story on the Seeger sessions?
Well, I wasn't part of that at all.
Oh, you doing part
no,
of that?
No, no. I worked with Bruce a couple of times. It was great. We worked a couple of those Christmas shows down in Asbury Park that were uh-huh. just great. We had great fun. And I played bass on one track, but I didn't get credited.
Was the only time you worked with him?
I didn't get credited because nobody but E Street Band guys get credited, but I got paid.
Yeah.
They said to me, hey, we paid you, you know.
Who was the best, like, when you talk about
he
Keith.
He was great in the room, though.
He's nice
Bruce
guy.
Bruce in the room with his book.
Yeah.
Writing songs in front of your very eyes,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But who's the, like, you talk about Keith and, you know, the guys who, you know, you got... Like, you have the opportunity to drive your band, but when you're working with
well, other Levon, people... Levon, when we did the, you know, we put the Barn Burners together.
Yeah.
And then after that, we started the Ramble
uh-huh.
there, you know?
Uh-huh.
So working with, turning around with Levon Helm on drums yeah. And Garth, you know, sometimes,
yeah.
That, being around those guys,
yeah.
for me too,
yeah.
like everyone else we've talked about, there's something that comes out of them.
Yeah, yeah.
As I saw them many times as a unit and was blown away every time, no matter what shape they were in.
Uh-huh.
Something great. It was kind of like a jalopy with bad springs going uh-huh. down the road. It'll get you there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Just yeah. don't get sick, you know? Some people that you wouldn't imagine, a guy named Willie Nile, who I've known for so long, every time I played with him, pure.
Yeah.
Like punk rock, you yeah. know, pure. B.B.
Yeah.
King, anytime.
Yeah.
You know, anytime. Al Cooper, John Sebastian, my friends, Felix Cavalieri, you know, all these great players. Johnny Johnson was key. Levon was key in my upbringing. Even at an older age, I was still learning stuff from these guys. You
like
know?
What?
Well, you know, Johnny Johnson was great at saying, you know, at look, shooting you a look across the stage if you were playing too busy.
Right.
You know? Bernard Purdy was great in saying that if your rhythm is louder than my hi-hat, then it's too loud.
Yeah.
When you solo, you can play as loud as you want. But when you're playing rhythm, you better hear my hi-hat, you know, and the bass player better be with my bass drum. You know, I mean, this is the greatest drummer, you know, one of the greatest drummers ever. And when
right.
they give you advice,
you
better
it.
Listen to them, you know?
Yeah.
And Levon's thing was, he was great, man, about don't play it, you know, the way anyone else has ever played it. I realized with Levon that the arrangements came from within.
Right.
He didn't want anybody walking in like what I was used to doing, saying, okay, here's your part. He was like, let's get it out of each player. This is the way the band must have operated.
Right.
That it was an organic thing. It came together. You know, they took time to make arrangements. It didn't, nobody wrote it down and said,
right,
here's how it goes.
Just kept playing it.
And each person was responsible for their yard, you know?
Yeah.
And then their own side of the street, as it were.
Right,
you know? And,
right.
And, but at the same time, you have to be aware of what's going on around you, and there's a space that needs to happen. They were great at, you know, Garth would weave. You know, Levon said when we cut this record about 15 years ago, he said, I went back for the second set of sessions after Johnny Johnson had gone back to St. Louis, and Mike and James were in New York, and I said to Lee, how about if I call, you know, Rick and Weider and Randy and you and Garth and Richard Bell, and we do it, like, you know. He goes, well, we haven't played together in the studio for years. And I said, well, you need to. You know, for me, you yeah. need to. So he said, yeah, but I'll tell you one thing. Don't bring Garth in for the sessions. Garth, he goes, bake the cake, and then Garth will put the icing on in the end, you know, and all the fancy stuff. Yeah. But the cake itself has to get baked, you know, first. And he knew from years that this guy was Garth is a genius.
Yeah.
You know, no one else that I know is a genius. Laura Nero may have been a genius, too. She she taught me a lot, you know, about singing.
Mm-hmm.
Her and Felix Cavalieri and Eddie Brigati from the Rascals,
mm-hmm.
they taught me more about singing than anybody, you know?
Yeah.
And Laura Nero, too, you know, and Dion.
Right.
You know, Dion DiMucci.
Yeah.
And we're still working together. We're going to make a record.
He does some blues records now, right?
Yeah, we're going to make one in October. I'm going to, somewhere.
I had no idea that he was doing those blues records. They're pretty amazing.
Yeah, because I put, when he came out of just singing Christian music.
Yeah.
And we did a big show.
I didn't
show.
Know he did that.
Yeah, we did a big show. My friend Dick Fox called me, who was going to manage Dion. And he used to put all those oldies shows together. He said, Dion's not an oldies guy, man. He's a rock and roll guy. You know, Lou Reed was hanging with him and shit, you know.
Yeah.
And we put a great show together at that. The reunion of him and a lot of the Belmonts, you know, and the Del Satins. And we did like his entire book, including Abraham Martin and John, like everything. And then we just got to be buddies, like Bronx buddies.
Yeah.
You know, and we're still really great friends to this day, and we're going to work together more.
Did you know any of those punk guys? Did you know Thunders and those guys?
I knew Thunders. I had to, because, you know, I Johansson and I are really tight. We work with Hubert, you know, together, and he knew my brother Floyd, and, you know, David was always one of my buddies, man. So, you know, Thunders, I met. We had gone up to some fucking shooting gallery together or something, you know, and I didn't know where I was going.
Right.
We were out somewhere at a club, and he said, let's jam.
Yeah.
Johnny said, I said, okay. So we go up to this place. It's like a loft, and people are just laying around.
Yeah,
right? There's instruments set up, though.
Yeah.
And then by the time I was not doing any of that. I was just drinking, you know? I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And then we were going to play, and nothing was happening, man, you know. And I realized that this is a long process to get something happening.
With him.
Yeah, he really meant well to play.
Yeah.
He wanted to play.
Yeah.
But he couldn't play.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at that point. Though he made some great music. I think the Heartbreaker stuff is some of my favorite.
It's great.
Chinese Rocks.
It's great.
And, you know,
that first fucking New York Dolls record.
Yeah, yeah. It's him crazy. And Jerry Nolan were great together.
Yeah, both of them dead.
Yeah, yeah. And Dee Dee, you know.
Yeah.
The Heartbreakers with Dee Dee and him and Jerry. And Dee Dee gone.
Yeah.
You know, I knew Joey pretty good. Joey was a sweet guy. He was like us with records.
Yeah.
You know, Joey would talk to you like he was so tall.
Yeah.
And talk out of the side of his mouth. So I got this, you know, that record by the teddy bears, you know, like the most.
Yeah.
And he was a vinyl nut, man. Like 45s.
Yeah.
You know, Joey.
Oh, he really liked
what's
stuff.
On A side, B side label.
Oh, really?
You know, like that scene in Diner.
Yeah, he was that guy.
Where Daniel Stern's like, okay, I'm not going to marry you. Can you tell me what's the B side of this record? You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not.
What color was the label? You know, it's really great.
Yeah, I'm not that much of a nerd, but I like listening to the music.
No. I mean, you know good music, man. You know,
I do.
Well, you know what you like and what you don't like.
Well, I keep learning new stuff. You know, I keep like hearing stuff that I never knew. You know, it's just it's amazing, like stuff I missed.
Yeah,
and it's great to be able. That's the great thing about music is you can always discover it. It doesn't go away.
Well, the great thing about New York at the time that I was playing there in the early '90s was in the '80s. Was I got to, you know, through my playing in a club uptown, I got to know Donald Fagen. I got to know Warren Haynes. I got to know Derek Trucks when he was a kid. You know, all yeah. these guys would come into this club I played, and we would play.
Yeah.
You know, I had a band with Harvey Brooks, a little big band, and yeah. we played at a place called Hades on 94th Street, and Fagan lived around the corner. And he would come and sit in, you know. And then we started doing these New York Nights things and these rock and soul reviews. And one night, Walter Becker walks in, and he's walking along the wall. And me, I'm just going to be the big mouth Italian and call him up.
Right.
Make him shame him into coming
right.
up. And he was very private. He didn't want to play.
Yeah.
But he did play. And then Steely Dan got back together.
Right.
You know, because they realized that they should be playing together.
Why not?
You know? Now, Walter and I have this love hate relationship, you know,
yeah.
that's great.
Well, that's the amazing thing about New York, too, and maybe a little in L.A., but it seems more in New York, is that people go out,
yeah.
you know, you go four blocks to see your buddy play, and then if you set up an environment where you can make that shit happen,
yeah.
they're like, come on, you can, and your band can hold it, so you hold the space for these guys to be able
yeah.
to do that.
I think what keyed Walter was when Donald and I were doing these gigs together,
yeah.
someone took a picture of me and Donald, and then there's a Steely Dan bootleg that came out on CD, and it's a picture of me and Donald, and Walter sends it to me, and he
what
says, what's this? I send him back. I said, you were never that good looking, first of all. And second of all, all that means is you should be playing with Donald, and it shouldn't be me on the cover of that CD.
Yeah.
You know?
And then they got back together.
But a brilliant cat, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was such a fan of those guys. And we get to meet them, and most of the time, you know, Donald, Michael McDonald, night greatest guy, man. You meet these guys, Boz Scaggs, and you find them along the way that 99% of the people you love are
pretty
great
good guys.
People. You
except
know?
For Chuck Berry.
Yeah, but to everybody, if he could punch Keith Richard
yeah.
and he could like diss John Lennon
yeah.
on the Mike Douglas show,
right?
Well, then why not me?
Yeah, it's just a general problem.
Listen, I was walking out of NBC once and Rickles was around, you know,
yeah.
and I had my long black coat on and a hat, and he goes, And I let him in the elevator, and he says, thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah.
I said, well, that's good. I got insulted by Rickles. In a way, I got recognized.
That's
you know?
Right. That's right.
It's like Bob Dylan. If he says something good or bad to you, he said something to you.
Have you had experience with him?
I don't talk about it, but yeah. Yeah. I love Bob Dylan.
What do you
I love
mean?
Him.
You don't talk about it.
I love him, you know?
You played with him?
Yeah. But, you know, we've had moments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes any connection
yeah.
with these guys is enough.
Doesn't matter, know? Good or bad.
It doesn't matter. On a good day, you don't get a good day every day.
No,
you know?
No.
And just the fact that they see you, for better or worse, you
right.
know, in a room
yeah.
and recognize you is enough.
Sure.
You know, I've had mostly good experiences, you
yeah.
know?
Good.
And unlike anybody else, there will never be... another Bob Dylan. Nobody will ever be as great as Bob Dylan to
right.
me.
Right.
As important in
right.
my life. You know, because I think that he's in the center of all of this. You know, what's happening.
Right.
You know, and will be for... Now he made a Frank Sinatra record or something. Right?
Did he?
He made a record like at Capitol or something. I don't know. He made like a...
It's not
some
out yet?
Sort of a, no, it's not out yet, but he made some sort of a standards record.
Interesting.
But, you know, I mean, why not?
Well, now also with the way that the singer-songwriter thing is happening again, he's just really still at the center of it.
Well, I mean, every record has great songs on it.
Yeah. No doubt.
You know, and always
yeah.
have. And,
yeah.
and boy, that last one,
yeah.
the Duquesne Whistle, the very first song on it, just kills me.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. He's,
and the Roman Kings, I mean, there's just so much great music.
Yeah,
in
he's,
this
he's just a mountain.
Well, you know, a great writer doesn't have to just write about their life. You know, what happens with, and comedy too, and music, a lot of people become complacent in their success,
right.
and then they can't write anymore,
right.
or they can't be funny anymore.
Right.
But a true writer
can't stop.
Doesn't really, he's not just telling you about himself
right.
or what's going on in his life. He's an observation, you know?
Yeah.
He can always see and feel what's, and he's plus also well-read.
Right. Right,
so
right.
fiction.
Right. And he also has got that hunger. He's still hunting.
And fiction is the biggest part of his life. He's the biggest
yeah.
bullshitter going. He
I
always
need,
has
need,
been, right?
Oh,
always.
Yeah. Bob,
he invented
yeah.
himself.
Sure. Always. Every
you know.
Every few years.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's I could use a little fiction.
Well, no, I mean, you know, we go through it. We go through the yeah. same thing. We're like in purgatory with women and with everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
I just keep perpetuating the same fucking mistake. You know, but that's okay.
I do too.
Yeah, but it's as long as it's not with the same person over and over again.
Well, the trick is not to get cynical.
Well, that's then we have neither of us have a career.
All right, Jimmy. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
How amazing was that? I got to play with Jimmy Vivino. think I did okay. I think I dropped the ball for a second, but I did all right. It was nerve-wracking. I was nervous. Love that guy. Go to JimmyVivino.com if you want to pick up his record and check out the history of Jimmy Vivino. It's great. Isn't it great to, like, you know, you see that guy in Conan, and now you know that guy. What a great musician. Well, I love him. I love him. Go to WTFpod.com. Get that app if you want it. JustCoffee.coop, as always. They've been with me for years, since before this show. JustCoffee.coop has been with me. Yeah, they were one of my first advertisers back when I was doing a streaming video show. All right, let's see if I can manage this fucking guitar. I think I'm just going to do... Like, you can't do any songs because then I have to pay for them. But that's fortunate because I don't know too many songs. But let's see. Maybe I'll get on a psychedelic muddy riff. But not a Muddy Waters riff, but just a muddy... I like three chords. Three chords is good. Shut up. If you're going to play. I don't know what just happened there. Boomer lives!